From NPR and WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Is the president criminally liable? That question hanging over the January 6th investigation was also being whispered in the White House while the Capitol insurrection was underway, according to Cassidy Hutchinson, top aide to former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, who told the House committee yesterday that after the insurrection began, the president was stewing because the Secret Service wouldn't let him go to the Capitol. Then she said White House counsel Pat Cipollone told her if he went, they'd face every criminal charge possible. Here's Hutchinson yesterday with committee chair Liz Cheney.
Mr. Cipollone said something to the effect of, please make sure we don't go up to the Capitol, Cassidy. Keep in touch with me. We're going to get charged with every crime imaginable if we make that movement happen.
And do you remember which crimes Mr. Cipollone was concerned with?
In the days leading up to the 6th, we had conversations about potentially obstructing justice or defrauding the electoral count.
Hutchinson also said that President Trump knew some of his followers were armed but wanted them to go to the Capitol anyway, and that many in his inner circle seemed to know before January 6th that, as Mark Meadows said, things might get bad. So what are the legal implications of yesterday's testimony? Jill Wine Banks is one of the prosecutors during the Watergate scandal. She wrote the book, The Watergate Girl, My Fight for Truth and Justice Against a Criminal President, and joins us now. Jill, first, your general thoughts watching yesterday.
I thought it was very powerful. I thought that Cassidy Hutchinson was a very good witness, good memory, good calm demeanor, clearly a Republican who supported the president, but was outraged by what she had seen and was willing to share the facts. Mm-hmm. And she shared facts and details in a way that seemed very true and compelling, very believable.
Yeah, what does it all mean, though? She mentioned obstruction of justice, as we just heard, and what she called defrauding the electoral count. Now, there's a timeline forming here through the committee's work. On January 2nd, the president called Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger and asked him to find votes. On January 3rd, the president met with Jeffrey Clark, the low-level Justice Department lawyer, and considered making him a stop-the-steal sympathizer, attorney general. That would have captured the DOJ. On January 4th, Hutchinson said the deputy chief of staff told his boss, Mark Meadows, about warnings that there could be violence. Now, people are using the phrase seditious conspiracy. First of all, what does that mean?
Okay, so first let me say, before I answer about seditious conspiracy, that I think what Cassidy Hutchinson was referring to was obstruction of Congress, not of justice, and conspiracy to defraud the U.S., which are both felonies. 2384 of Title 18 is seditious conspiracy. And the interesting thing about that is it would bar anybody convicted of that from ever holding office again. So it becomes even more than just a felony. And it basically says if two or more people anywhere conspire to overthrow, put down, or destroy by force the government of the United States, that is a crime. And so that makes the intent about violence important. And so when you say that there was evidence, which there was, that they were told that there was violence, that even on the day of, they got reports about AK-47s and Glock pistols and brass knuckles. That means violence. And if you then say, go to Congress and fight like hell, that makes you guilty of Title 18, Section 2384. Well, and so I think that that's why that became very important.
Well, Saul Weisenberg, who was a former deputy to Watergate prosecutor Ken Starr, I'm sure you know, told the New York Times that yesterday's hearing was this smoking gun pointing at seditious conspiracy. And earlier this month, prosecutors added charges of seditious conspiracy to their case against members of the Proud Boys who were at the Capitol on January 6th. So if that was conspiracy for them and Trump wanted to join them, is that part of what makes him liable?
It is, but I think we probably will have evidence that shows that he encouraged them to do that, that he was the leader of them, that it wasn't that he was joining them, that they were joining him, which makes him the ringleader. But even if he just was joining them by his intent of, I'm going there, I will march with you, and his insistence in the vehicle that he be taken to the Capitol, that means that he wanted to be part of the violence, that he wanted to interfere with Congress. Any one of these crimes is a terrible thing to think that the President of the United States was guilty of. In addition to, you mentioned Georgia, where there the phone call to Brad Raffensperger, which is a violation of state law. So he's got crimes coming at the federal level and at the state level.
Yeah. We should say that the Secret Service is reportedly saying that they've notified the committee that they'll make those agents involved in what happened in the car when the president allegedly lunged and said he wanted to go to the Capitol. They're going to testify, you know, whether or not he lunged. And so we'll be hearing about that. But meantime, we know that, as you said, the president knew the mob was armed. He knew it before the insurrection. Is that also perhaps inciting a riot?
Well, the inciting the riot is his words. And that's not just his words on January 6th. We can go back to before the election. The only way I can lose this election, he said, is if it's rigged. So he started that fake narrative of fraud in the election long before there was anybody voting. And it continues to this day. He is still claiming the election was stolen despite the absence of a single shred of evidence, despite 60 courts throwing it out, despite the Arizona ninjas finding more votes for President Biden than they had before they did the audit. So there's no evidence to support that, and continuing to repeat that is part of inciting the crowd to riot, and telling them, you need to protect me and democracy.
And Jill Winebanks, we're going to have you back because we just love your expertise. We only have a few seconds here. Do you think that there, from what you heard yesterday, there will be other people who will be open to charges?
Oh, absolutely. I think we heard enough about Mark Meadows, and we have to look at all the people who requested pardons. You don't ask for pardon unless you've done something that is a crime. And there were many people asking for pardons. And so we have to look at all of those people, as well as Mark Meadows, Jim Jordan, Brooks, Biggs, Gates, all of them.
Jill Winebanks, who helped prosecute Watergate, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And now the latest on that deadly earthquake in Afghanistan that hit a remote, impoverished area of the country nearly a week ago. Hundreds of people died, but the disaster has mobilized Afghans to help each other, NPR's Dia Hadid reports.
When the earthquake shook the district of Bermal, it caused Rajigul's house to collapse over his sleeping family. It killed his son and daughter, and he was trapped. He says, I tried calling for help, but I was buried under the mud. It was coming into my mouth. Gul was ultimately pulled out by relatives. It's stories like this, of parents losing children, others left orphaned, that has mobilized Afghans. In the capital, Kabul, is Parwiz Hamdard. He's collecting cash, clothes, pots, pants, whatever Afghans can give. And he says Afghans are giving what they can.
It makes us so happy because people here are very poor, but still Afghans come and donate for their people.
As Hamdard speaks to NPR producer Fazul Minallah Kazizai, a man walks over and drops 40 Afghanis into a collection box. That's about 4 cents. It buys about 4 pieces of bread. The man donating is Muhammad Bilal Shaheen. He's 23, unemployed.
I donated what I could. We've got to help those people as much as we can.
Hamdard says it's been like this since he began Monday. He says people aren't just giving from what little they have. They're giving to people outside their own communities. He says, that's no small thing in Afghanistan, where minorities have viewed each other with mistrust for decades. The earthquake's victims are from Afghanistan's Pashtun community, but the people donating to them in this area are mostly Uzbek and Hazara Afghans.
It was a good experience for us to see. Afghans, Hazara, Uzbek, Pashtuns, they want to help each other.
On the road to Kabul, to areas destroyed by the earthquake, motorists drop change in charity boxes at rest stops. Hamdard says Afghans are showing their unity.
Leaders divide us, but we are working for one Afghanistan.
This may be the most Afghans have mobilized since the Taliban seized power almost a year ago. And while the modest amounts donated by Afghans won't amount to the millions that the UN says are needed, what they're giving is symbolically important, showing that despite decades of war, there is still care and concern for each other. Dia Hadid, NPR News.
Today we have results from the first primary election since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. We're going to check in on two states, Colorado and Illinois. Both saw Democrats try to convince voters to choose more right-wing Republican candidates, which Democrats thought would be easier to beat. This effort paid off in Illinois, but not in Colorado. Let's start there with Benta Berkland, public affairs reporter for Colorado Public Radio. And Benta, there in Colorado, in some big races, the centrist Republicans did win over the far-right Republicans. Start with the primary for U.S. Senate. Joe O'Dea over Ron Hanks. What happened?
Yes, Joe O'Dea is a first-time candidate. He's a contractor. He started his own business when he was still in college. And yes, I would point out that he is a lot more moderate than Ron Hanks. O'Dea backed the Biden administration's infrastructure package. He supports legal abortion in the early stages of pregnancy. And even though the issue of abortion came up in Colorado's primary race, O'Dea has repeatedly said he's not focused on social issues. Instead, O'Dea talks a lot about high inflation, gas prices, and reducing crime. And yes, it was very interesting in this race to look at the spending, because Democratic groups spent a lot of money to try to boost O'Dea's primary opponent. They did feel that O'Dea would be tougher to beat this fall. O'Dea is challenging Democratic Senator Michael Bennet.
Well, and I'm sure some listeners are saying, wow, a Republican who supports any, you know, right to abortion. But there you have it, Joe O'Dea in that race. And in the primary race for Secretary of State, Pam Anderson beat Tina Peters. Now, she's an election denier. She's facing criminal charges for tampering with election equipment. Tell us more about the charges against her and how she sought this nomination for Secretary of State.
Yes. So Peters entered the race. She was one of the last one to enter the race. There were three candidates, and I actually attended the watch party for Tina Peters. She ended up coming in third behind Anderson and then a political newcomer, Mike O'Donnell. And Peters was definitely the most polarizing of the three candidates. So she's facing 10 state criminal charges for an alleged attempt to uncover election rigging by her county's voting machines. And some of the password and hardware information ended up being posted online by election conspiracy theorists. And I think a lot of voters in Colorado clearly were not comfortable nominating someone to head the state's elections who is facing state charges and an ongoing federal investigation. Mm-hmm. Peters, I would say, did not accept the results of Tuesday's vote. And the winner of that race, Pam Anderson, she said she got into the race for Secretary of State to counter people like Peters who push false election fraud claims. And Anderson is a former clerk. She was the head of Colorado's Clerks Association. She supports the state's all-mail ballot election system, and she doesn't believe the 2020 presidential election was stolen. And I did talk to two Republican women who voted for more of the moderate candidates in Colorado, like Anderson, like O'Dea, and they said they really wanted Republican candidates who would listen, be moderate, and help Republicans make gains this fall. So for these voters, electability in the fall was key.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see what happens to Congresswoman Lauren Boebert, who won her primary, huge Trump backer this week, and she said she was tired of this separation of church and state junk. So it'll be interesting to see how she does in November. Benta Berkland, public affairs reporter for Colorado Public Radio. Thank you.
Thanks.
Let's turn now to Illinois, where Darren Bailey, endorsed by Trump, won the Republican nomination for governor. He'll face the Democratic incumbent J.B. Pritzker in November. Joining us now is Alex Degman, State House reporter for WBEZ in Chicago. And Alex, Tell us about this race. Bailey had Trump's endorsement on his side. He also had the support of Democrats who believed he'd be the easiest to beat in November. Explain this strategy and how it worked.
Yeah, so the Democratic Governors Association, and I guess by proxy, Governor J.B. Pritzker, pumped more than $30 million into this Republican primary. And they did that to attack the more moderate Richard Ervin, a suburban mayor, and paint him as basically a Republican in name only. Ervin was the establishment's choice, and he got a lot of support from party leaders, longtime Republican stakeholders. And the ads helped Bailey by focusing on Ervin's support for Black Lives Matter, his many years as a criminal defense attorney despite his tough-on-crime platform, his complimentary attitude toward Governor Pritzker during the pandemic, and later, they honed in on some of Ervin's opinions of former President Trump that were revealed in text messages. He wasn't complimentary. So the strategy here is to get the more conservative Republican primary voters to turn out and elect a candidate that traditionally can't win here statewide.
Interesting. Yeah. So tell us about that candidate, Darren Bailey. Chicago Sun-Times calls him a MAGA-loving, Bible-quoting grain farmer from downstate Illinois.
Well, Bailey is a Republican from southern Illinois, and there are pretty big cultural and political differences that don't translate to a lot of Chicago voters. Bailey even called Chicago, you might remember this, he called it a hellhole during a live debate in Chicago, and then he doubled down on it because he said people in Chicago were scared and they're tired of their concerns being unheard. But Illinois politics have been controlled largely by the Chicago area because that's where most of the population is, and as a large metropolitan area, stances like his on the far right don't typically do well there in the general, but things are different now. It wasn't that long ago that voters in Republican primaries were also concerned about November electability. And even if they didn't like a moderate candidate, they voted for that candidate just to try beating the Democrats. But Bailey won by about 40 points. And I think Illinois Republican voters are saying, you know, to heck with traditional views of electability. Let's get someone that we really want in there.
All right. So he'll face Governor J.B. Pritzker, the Democrat. Another notable race was Illinois' 15th district, where U.S. Congresswoman Mary Miller won. She stirred some controversy. Among other things, she said at a rally over the weekend that the decision to overturn Roe v. Wade is a victory for white life by the Supreme Court. Her campaign said she meant to say a victory for the right to life. But how much did Trump's endorsement factor into her win?
I think it mattered. It factored in quite a bit. Now, she had a pretty good chance to win this district anyway because it was drawn to favor Republicans. And Donald Trump, according to a recent poll we did, is still very popular among Republican voters here. And talking to people at that rally you mentioned in Mendon this past Saturday, a few made it clear to me that they were supporting Miller just because that is Trump's candidate, period. She's her person. But her opponent, Rodney Davis, had dozens of endorsements from sitting and retired lawmakers on all levels, local and statewide law enforcement organizations, county GOP groups, but ultimately, the endorsement that really mattered this year was Trump's.
Right, and she'll face Democrat Paul Lang, a Democrat, but this is a heavily Republican district, so an uphill battle for him, right?
Absolutely.
All right, that's Alex Degman, State House reporter for WBEZ Chicago. Alex, thanks so much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Okay, there's your roundup, and now we want to spend a few minutes in Michigan on a court's decision. Now, residents of Flint, Michigan are still seeking justice for the water crisis that began in 2014. You remember a switch in the source for the city's drinking water resulted in high lead levels, bacteria outbreaks, people died. Many are still suffering from ailments. And yesterday, the state Supreme Court handed down a decision that threw out charges against some of the officials who many believe are responsible for the crisis. Michigan Public Radio's senior Capitol correspondent Rick Pluta joins us now by Skype to talk about that. And Rick, first, remind us of the details of this case in the first place.
Sure. A lot of these officials who were charged say that they were denied a critical procedural measure, which is the preliminary hearing that you get called in and the prosecution has to tell something about what it has on the defendants to allow the case to go forward. Well, the prosecutor here, the Solicitor General, who's part of our Attorney General's office, instead used something that's not typical, where a special prosecutor, who's basically a judge and a prosecutor, hears the case, decides the case, and decides whether or not to move ahead with the case. And these defendants said, no, we get a preliminary hearing where a separate judge, not someone who's acting as both prosecutor and judge, makes a determination on whether or not this case goes forward. And we get to hear it, and we get to challenge the evidence.
So my understanding, the Supreme Court agreed with them. And did they throw everything out?
They said either the case is over, or you have to go back and recharge and hold a preliminary hearing. And our Solicitor General has said that is what she's going to do, is that they're going to schedule preliminary hearings, and they're going to have to tip their hand as to what they may have to try and convict these public officials.
And who are we talking about here? Who are the defendants here?
Well, in this particular case, it is an aide to now former Governor Rick Snyder, the former Department of Health and Human Services director. His name is Nick Lyon, and some other top health officials in the state of Michigan.
And what about former Governor Rick Snyder himself?
Well, he was not specifically part of this case. However, his legal team is looking at this and saying, we're going to try and have some of these charges dismissed based on the reasoning that the Supreme Court used in this case that pulled in other administration officials.
Okay, so it sounds like everyone's in a huddle deciding what they do next. But meantime, just briefly, we have less than a minute. What are people there saying?
There is still a lot of anger over the Flint water crisis, that this was done as something that was supposed to help the city of Flint save money, and it mm-hmm. turned out just disastrously. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of people, especially in the city of Flint, who would like to see government officials held responsible.
Yeah. We will wait to see what happens next. Michigan Public Radio's Rick Pluta, thanks so much for bringing us up to date.
Thank you, Robin.
Travel is nearly back to pre-pandemic levels. The U.S. Travel Association reports that about 6 in 10 Americans are taking at least one trip this summer. Well, Katie Sewell of the Bittersweet Life podcast has this essay about the thing most of us take when we go.
I used to have a suitcase, but it recently kicked the bucket. The zipper broke. I was planning on getting it repaired, but my partner Derek had me look at the luggage objectively. Like, really look at it. See what rough shape it's in. Is that something that's worth repairing? It wasn't easy for me to view it objectively. I had owned this suitcase since middle school. My parents bought it for me for Christmas. I can still picture it under the tree. My very first suitcase. And the freedom of that. They bought me a green bag rather than a black one, so it would stand out from everyone else's luggage. Such an unusual color of green. I have never seen another like it. So when I was standing there, trying to look at that broken bag objectively, I saw all of that. The Christmas morning. My parents picking it out. My first piece of luggage. But I also saw the 7 or 8 times that I traveled to Vietnam with my father for his work. In fact, there were traces of the baggage inspected stickers still stuck to the bag, different colors for different years. And the handle was covered with different color ribbons. We often traveled to Vietnam in big groups of people, and this was a little tip, that if you put the same colored ribbons on all of the bags, you can collect suitcases from baggage claim even if half your party is in the bathroom. Those trips were such an experience for me that I just left all the ribbons on the bag. So when I looked at that bag, I could see all of that. I could also see my first trip to Europe, all the visits I made to my grandparents. I could see road trips and plane trips, train trips, bus trips. It was no surprise that the zipper broke. It had been threatening to for years. And when it finally did go off track, I kept the bag. I was hoping to fix it. But then, the mold. A white, powdery mold from a damp basement. It covered the entire suitcase, inside and out. So I took it outside with a sponge. And that's when Derek intervened, saying, "It's time for something new. You should look at this objectively." So I did. I looked at it. I looked at it standing up with its lid flopped open, full of mold, full of rips and punctures, same strange green color. I could see what he was saying. This luggage had been everywhere, and it looked like it had been everywhere. It was time. Time to let go of my travel companion. Even still, it took a lot for me to leave that piece of luggage out by the trash. I opened all of its pockets. I noticed all of the stickers, all of the notches, all the scratches, all the fades. But I did leave it there. And the next morning, it was gone. I still haven't purchased another. It is still the only suitcase that has ever truly been mine. And the funny thing about such a precious and practical object, I don't even have a picture of it. Because when you're out exploring the world, the last thing you consider documenting is the object that helped make it possible. For Here and Now, I'm Kitty Sewell.
When it comes to some of the industrial chemicals known as PFAS, the EPA now says there's no safe amount in drinking water. PFAS stands for polyfluoroalkyl substances, and they're widely used in products like Teflon pans, fire retardants, as well as in lots of other household products. They're often called forever chemicals because they don't degrade or degrade very slowly and last, well, they last nearly forever. Now, the dire federal warning didn't surprise communities affected by these chemicals, including Wilmington, North Carolina, where the Chemours chemical plant is now under court order to reduce the release of PFAS into the area's air, water, and soil. WHQR reporter Kelly Knoyer has been following the story and joins us now. Kelly, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So my understanding is that communities in and around Wilmington and the Cape Fear watershed area have been devastated by PFAS chemicals, one called Gen X in particular. Can you start by describing some of the effects that this chemical is having on local residents?
So one of the things that's most concerning to local residents is that it's not entirely clear exactly what health effects come from Gen X. It's not as well studied as some of the legacy chemicals PFOS and PFOA, but it is also likely to cause immune defects, potentially cancer, decreased fertility, low birth weight. There's liver issues as well. The main concern for folks who live in this community is that Gen X has been coming into our watershed for decades. We didn't find out about it until 2017, and then they put a cap on how much of it could be released into the river from the Chemours plant. Previously, they could put their water directly into the river without any kind of filtration. And now, after this news broke in 2017, there's been a consent decree that requires them to limit their emissions a bit more. So our local Department of Environmental Quality set a level of 140 parts per trillion at that time. Now the EPA has come out and said that 10 parts per trillion is a more appropriate level. But there's a concern that this still doesn't go far enough, or that other chemicals, which are still unregulated entirely, might also be causing the same kinds of health impacts because they're also related.
So, Kelly, what are you hearing from people from the community that are affected by this pollution?
You know, there's a lot of people who've been activists for a long time. Dana Sargent's the executive director of Cape Fear River Watch, and her brother Grant died of cancer several years ago. She thinks that because he was a firefighter in Chicago, he was exposed to higher levels of PFAS than a lot of other people, and she thinks that's why he got cancer. Similar story, this actually came from a recent public hearing for a permit for Chemours to release water into the river. Sheil Patel, who's a high school student here, he talked about his neighbors getting cancer.
My neighbors, who live on the road right next to my cul-de-sac, were a perfectly healthy couple who had moved into Wilmington 10 years ago. Over the last 3 years, the wife developed ovarian cancer and the husband developed liver cancer. They told me they strongly believed that it was our contaminated drinking water that caused their cancers.
So, Kelly, that's one anecdote. Are there other similar cases of those kinds of cancers around there?
You know, a lot of people think that there's a heightened risk of cancer in this area, but there's still a lot of monitoring going on. We don't really know exactly whether cancer is a higher risk here or if it's directly caused by the Gen X exposure. Unlike other legacy chemicals, Gen X doesn't bioaccumulate in the body, so it runs through you. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't have health impacts. You know, if you drink a lot the night before, you might still have a hangover, but you won't test for a high level of blood alcohol the next day. That doesn't mean that your health hasn't been impacted by drinking heavily. And it's similar for Gen X. Because this stuff doesn't bioaccumulate, it's hard to track exactly how much people have had as far as lifetime exposure. And the levels were significantly higher before Chemours had this consent decree limit their emissions. For folks who've lived in the community for a long time, not knowing what those levels were like back in 2004 before it was regulated at all, it's really concerning. And they don't really know what the impacts actually have been. People go to the doctor and they ask whether this is something that could be impacting them. And doctors have to just say, I don't know. There's no way of us knowing exactly how much you've been exposed to. We cannot confirm that this is what caused your cancer, this is what caused your liver disease.
I see. So given all that, are people in these communities comfortable with what's being done in terms of the consent decrees and in terms of the conditions that are being placed on the Chemours plant?
I would say no. So that same hearing that I went to, where Sheel Patel gave his commentary, they were demanding that instead of 99% of the PFAS in the water being removed, they wanted it to be 100%, down to non-detect levels. And that would be more in line with what the EPA has now said the health advisory should be. The issue with the Chemours plant is that there is decades of buildup of forever chemicals under the plant. It's leaking out of the groundwater. So the local Department of Environmental Quality is requiring Chemours to build this large wall around the entire plant deep underground to capture the water and send it to wells where it can then be filtered. But they're only requiring them to filter out 99% of the PFAS currently. A lot of residents want to see significantly higher levels than that.
The EPA is saying there is no safe level when it comes to drinking water, for example.
Exactly. And another thing that's of great concern to folks in this community is that they're only setting these expectations for three chemicals for Chemours and four at the EPA level. But there are 9,000 different PFAS in the world, 9,000 known PFAS chemicals. And they're only regulating four at the federal level. So the rest of those, which are related, likely to have similar health effects, they haven't got any regulation whatsoever.
Wow. So, Kelly, give me a sense of what the state of North Carolina is saying about all this, given what the EPA is saying. Or is the state going further than what the EPA is recommending?
So historically, the state of North Carolina has been quite conservative on PFAS, but recently there's been a change in leadership, and the DEQ is now saying that they're going to go after 10 to 15 additional PFAS and set drinking water standards for those as well. But even then, I would say a lot of activists and scientists say that that's not going far enough. I have a clip from Duke scientist Lee Ferguson about that issue.
I think we are right now in the decision point that previous generations of scientists and regulators were at with things like PCBs and asbestos. I call it environmental whack-a-mole.
Environmental whack-a-mole. Kelly, what is the Chemours Chemical Company saying about the new rules and what it and other companies are being asked to do?
So Chemours has had an ad campaign in this area for several months now where they call themselves a good neighbor, and that's infuriated local activists and residents. But Chemours has threatened to sue the Environmental Protection Agency after they came out with these health advisories, saying that it goes too far and that it's not in line with science. They have their own studies that they'll cite saying that these chemicals are actually not that dangerous and that these non-detect levels are going too far. So it seems clear that this is something that they're planning to fight against. They haven't actually sued the EPA quite yet, but they've threatened to.
Kelly, I want to come back to one thing that you mentioned earlier. You said that there are 9,000 identified PFAS chemicals, but the federal government only sets health advisories on four of them. Why is that?
You know, I think it's a matter of not having the studies that show that each of these individual chemicals is dangerous. But a lot of activists, a lot of scientists believe that it would be reasonable to set standards that are based on families of PFAS. That's the way that the European Union is planning to regulate PFAS. They've gone much further than the United States has. And that's the kind of thing that advocates suggest we should do.
All right. Well, that's WHQR reporter Kelly Kanoyer, who's been covering Wilmington, North Carolina's struggle to rid its water, soil, and air of PFAS chemicals. Kelly, thank you so much for your reporting. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's an honor.
PFAS aren't found only in industrial waste. One list put out by the Sierra Club includes kids' products like car seats and toys, along with household goods like rugs, furniture, food packaging, and clothing, including certain types of bras, pajamas, athletic wear, even yoga pants. So what steps can consumers take to avoid these chemicals? Clean Water Action recommends using glass containers for your to-go food, ditching non-stick cookware, even if it says PFAS-free, and avoid those stain-resistant coatings. And if you've been using microwave popcorn bags, you might want to switch to an air popper or a pan on the stovetop. And check your dental floss, because some brands are coated with PFAS. You can find links to PFAS-free resources at hereandnow.org. And while you're on our website, you can help us with a story we're working on. A labor shortage means teenagers will be in great demand for jobs this summer. If you're a teen, let us know if you're taking the plunge into the hot job market. And if you're not looking for a job, what are your summer plans? Parents, let us know if your teenager wants to weigh in. Share your story at hereandnow.org.
State laws banning abortion are raising chilling questions about medical privacy and whether law enforcement will be able to access patient health records. Some experts have concerns about how much privacy laws will hold up and just how much clinics and patients may be subject to legal action. Eric Budman is a reporter with our partners at health and medical publication Stat News. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Robin.
Well, the medical privacy law we think of most is HIPAA, because whenever we want to find out things about, you know, our loved ones who are getting health care or even ourselves, we sometimes can't do it because of HIPAA laws. But you found that these laws are not that tight when it comes to other concerns. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the privacy protections of HIPAA contain exceptions or carve-outs for legal proceedings, which means that if the right documents are presented, you know, a subpoena, a warrant, a court order, that kind of thing, a clinic could be required to turn over those medical records. So I think they're not quite as watertight as many patients and even doctors think they might be.
Okay, then. Well, that's records that are at a clinic. But we live in a digital world. You know, we have a trail of information. We text with doctors. We do Google searches. And, you know, some people use apps, for instance, to track their menstruation and their fertility cycles. We understand that there's concern that maybe Google search engines might be asked by courts to give up that information. But how else might someone have information that they think is protected and maybe lose it, lose that protection?
So law enforcement have definitely used location data and texts to prosecute crimes. They may need a certain kind of warrant to do that, but those data are out there. And so really what legal experts are saying is if you're living in a state that bans abortion and you're looking at that kind of procedure, you just really need to be mindful of all the ways that you're generating data. And that could be in the text messages you send, the numbers that you call, the searches that you do, even in the location data that your phone collects.
Could federal officials, though, now move to strengthen medical privacy laws given that?
That is something that legal experts say could potentially happen, although, as they've pointed out, we're in this moment where, for instance, executive action, you know, executive orders are not necessarily looked upon in a friendly way in the courts. So it's a little unclear as to how that might actually play out and whether those would actually be upheld.
Well, and we're also hearing that women are being advised to do things like, if you are doing a Google search, to purchase medication-based abortion. These are the two-part pills that will induce an abortion. We understand that some women are being told to cross a state line and do your online ordering or maybe calling a clinic from a state where abortion is legal. I mean, this is just sounding like it's going to get very netty. But what are the prospects of there being laws that might strengthen privacy of your medical work online in a search engine like Google? I mean, it's one thing to strengthen the records that are already at your healthcare provider, but is there any sense of strengthening any kind of medical information that's, you know, in a search engine, in a text?
That's a great question. And privacy experts look at this as a potentially bipartisan issue, even though, of course, abortion is deeply partisan. They say, really, you know, strengthening something like HIPAA or strengthening other privacy laws could be something that Republicans get behind as well. That said, I mean, if we look at how Congress is working and just the way things are going in D.C., you can tell me if that looks likely.
Yeah. Is there any advice for women wanting to protect themselves?
You know, legal experts are really saying just be careful about what you're doing online, what you're doing with your phone. And I think a really important point here is that there is some legal precedent whereby court orders and warrants and subpoenas can be blocked in court, where a judge might rule that no, an official cannot get access to these records. That said, it's sort of unclear what's going to happen with that precedent. I think, you know, the overturning of Roe v. Wade means legal experts are sort of really in a murky place in terms of making those predictions. And HIPAA can interact with state law in interesting ways that judges sometimes have to take into account. And so it gets complicated fast, which means that I think patients just shouldn't make assumptions. If they're in Oklahoma, it could be different than if you're in Texas.
Yeah. It's really chilling. Legal experts are telling you, the more online you are about your health, whether it's searches or texting with people, the greater your exposure. They're even saying, leave your phone home. Why would you leave your phone home if you go to a clinic?
Because of those location data that your phone is collecting, that's something that law enforcement has used in the past with a warrant, and so legal experts see that as a potential liability. Mm.
That's Eric Budman, a reporter with Stat News, a health and medicine publication. We'll link you to their writing about some of the legal privacy fears about the new abortion laws. Eric, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, Robin.
Leave your phone home when you go to a health clinic so you won't be tracked. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Anthony Brooks. It's Here and Now.